With Israel in the spotlight, President Joe Biden makes the case for continuing support for Ukraine.
If we walk away and let Putin erase Ukraine's independence, would-be aggressors around the world would be emboldened to try the same. The risk of conflict and chaos could spread in other parts of the world, in the Indo-Pacific, in the Middle East, especially in the Middle East.
Plus, a pro-democracy group is working to gain back Republican support to fight authoritarians like Vladimir Putin.
The Republican Party of today, which is Donald Trump's Republican Party, does not stand up to authoritarians. Donald Trump does not stand up to Vladimir Putin. So that is one of the reasons for why we are where we are today.
And later in the program, the latest on Russia's detainment of yet another American journalist. Today is Friday, October 20th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening, I'm Lori London in Washington. Declaring that U.S. leadership holds the world together, President Joe Biden told Americans on Thursday night the country must deepen its support of Ukraine and Israel in the middle of two vastly different, unpredictable, and bloody wars.
Time is of the essence. I know we have our divisions at home. We have to get past them. We can't let petty, partisan, angry politics get in the way of our responsibilities as a great nation. We cannot and will not let terrorists like Hamas and tyrants like Putin win. I refuse to let that happen.
In his Oval Office address, Biden made a direct appeal to the American people to continue funding Ukraine and Israel amid their war efforts a day after returning from Tel Aviv to show support for Washington's key ally. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wiedekuswara has this report.
Displaced Palestinians sheltering in tents in southern Gaza as Israel continues its airstrikes, including one that turned this mosque in the central Gaza town of Deir al-Balah into rubble. This is the backdrop for President Joe Biden's remarks Thursday evening, fresh off his visit to Tel Aviv, as he asked for more funding for Israel, a key U.S. ally, as well as to support Ukraine against the Russian invasion.
Hamas and Putin represent different threats, but they share this in common. They both want to completely annihilate a neighboring democracy.
Israel has bombarded Gaza, killing 3,000 and displacing more than a million people, mostly Palestinian Arabs, in response to the militant group Hamas incursion on October 7th, which killed 1,400 people in retaliation for Israel's decades-long occupation. In supporting Israel, Biden said America must also keep its commitment to help Ukraine in its fight against Russia's invasion.
History has taught us that when terrorists don't pay a price for their terror, when dictators don't pay a price for their aggression, they cause more chaos and death and more destruction.
Biden did not say how much he is requesting. The amount will be known Friday when presented to Congress. The House must have a speaker to pass legislation. So far, no Republican has been able to secure the 217 votes needed to claim the speaker's gavel, following the ousting of former House Speaker Kevin McCarthy earlier this month. Meanwhile, protesters calling for a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas descended on the U.S. Capitol on Wednesday. An October 16 Reuters Ipsos poll shows that 41% says the U.S. should support Israel's position.
American leadership is what holds the world together. American alliances are what keep us, America, safe.
That argument will be viewed with skepticism. Massive, in some cases violent, anti-Israel and anti-U.S. demonstrations have erupted in various capitals around the world. Many protesters see Israel as an occupying force that continues to annex Palestinian territory, supported by the U.S., even as the administration denounces Russia's annexation of parts of Ukraine. Patsy Wiedekuswara, VOA News, Washington.
President Biden officially submitted his requested supplemental funding package Thursday, which includes billions of dollars in military and humanitarian aid for Israel and Ukraine, National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan on a media briefing call Friday.
As the president spoke about last night, we have to continue to stand up to tyranny and aggression and defend Ukraine against this brutal Russian invasion. We know from history that if we walk away and let someone like Vladimir Putin erase Ukraine's independence, he will not stop there, and would-be aggressors around the world would be emboldened. We have to send the unmistakable message that in the 21st century, a dictator can cannot be allowed to conquer or carve up his neighbor.
Reiterating the president's message, Sullivan noted a halt in funding would be a gift to Russian President Vladimir Putin.
He said that President Putin, reflecting on the possibility that America would stop providing assistance to Ukraine, President Putin said that Ukraine would have 1 week to live. 1 week to live. Putin is betting that the United States will walk away from defending its democratic partner, Ukraine, walk away from the coalition of countries it has built over the last 18 months, and Joe Biden and the American people are going to prove Vladimir Putin wrong, and we're asking Congress to join us in that.
He added that the weapons and military aid the U.S. and its allies and partners have provided for Ukraine over the past few years have made a tremendous difference in battles for Kyiv, Kherson, and Kharkiv. Biden faces an array of steep challenges, though, as he tries to secure the money. The House remains in chaos because the Republican majority has been unable to confirm a new leader in order to vote on any funding. Conservative Republicans oppose money for sending more weapons to Ukraine, but not all members are against the aid. Tatiana Voroshko with VOA's Ukrainian service spoke with Gunnar Raymer, spokesperson for the group Republicans for Ukraine, on why it's working so hard to garner renewed support from voters.
To remind those traditional Republicans out there that supporting democracy both here and abroad is a central tenet of the Republican Party of the past, and that Republicans should once again embrace that.
The House of Representatives is still in the middle of trying to elect the Speaker. Jim Jordan in the nominee, they're going to be another vote. Your organization graded him as F on Ukraine. What would be your notes to accompany the F mark?
Jim Jordan has taken a series of votes against supporting Ukraine and has made comments that lack support for Ukraine as well. And we gave him an F on the report card because we think that if you are an F on the report card, and we've called for the next Speaker of the House to be someone that supports Ukraine, and I'm optimistic that Patrick McHenry would be more supportive of Ukraine. He has a B- on our report card. So I really hope that in the interest of Ukraine that Jim Jordan is not the next Speaker of the House.
If he is a Speaker, would it just kill all Ukrainian legislation?
Jim Jordan has done nothing to prove that he would do anything to support Ukraine. So that would be my fear. Should Jim Jordan be the next Speaker of the House, I think that support from Congress for Ukraine is in serious jeopardy.
We expect the joint package, aid package for Israel and for Ukraine, and maybe also additional help for Taiwan and for South on border. Would it be possible for this package to go through the House of Representatives, even if Jim Jordan is a Speaker?
Even with the joint package, my fear is after McCarthy's ouster as Speaker of the House, that Republican rank-and-file members are afraid of this very loud minority within the Republican Party, like Matt Gaetz, that have sent a signal to Republicans that if they support Ukraine, it puts their job in jeopardy. So that is my concern, that Republican rank-and-file members of Congress will be concerned over this minority but very loud wing of the Republican Party that have overtaken the right-wing infotainment media space.
But what about the other minority or majority of those Republicans who do support Ukraine? Don't they have a voice?
They do have a voice, and I hope they use their voice. When you look at our report card, there's a lot of A's, but there's a lot of D's and F's, and I think that it shows just how split the Republican Party is on this issue. Again, my fear is that these A's and B's are afraid of alienating their constituency, this loud Donald Trump type of Republican primary voter, and there is this fear out there about alienating them. But I hope what our organization, Republicans for Ukraine, does is send a signal to both Republicans, everyday Republicans, and Republican leaders that there are these everyday Reagan-type Republicans out there that support Ukraine. And we think that Republicans for Ukraine is a very effective vehicle at communicating to Republicans out there that these types of Republicans still exist.
What's the main reasons for the support for Ukraine dropping and dropping precipitously among the Republican voter base?
So public polling did signal that support for Ukraine among Republicans was dropping. And when we are doing focus groups with Republican voters, the thing that we could notice is that this isolationist part of the party that Donald Trump has inspired is really taking over. The thing that we recognize and are disappointed with, that the Republican Party of today is Donald Trump's party, And on a whole host of issues, everyday Republicans are going to follow Trump. And as Trump continues to be more isolationist, as Trump refuses to stand up to Vladimir Putin, it's unsurprising at this point that there are Republicans out there that are beginning to wane their support for Ukraine. But what we hope our campaign does is fight back and push back against it by giving everyday Republicans the permission that, look, there are these Republicans out there that look and sound just like you, and this is how they feel about what we think is a very important issue.
But what drives it? I mean, like, is it they just don't want to spend money, or they just like dictatorship regimes like in Russia? They don't like Ukrainians because they fight for democracy.
Republicans like Ronald Reagan, and there still are some establishment Republicans out there, used to stand up to authoritarianism. That was the leading drive of the Republican Party. The Republican Party of today, which is Donald Trump's Republican Party, does not stand up to authoritarians. Donald Trump does not stand up to Vladimir Putin. So that is one of the reasons for why we are where we are today.
What messages resonates the most with Republicans who kind of maybe will support Ukraine?
I think the best message that we can put out there, and it's not only about the message, it's about the messenger. That's why we do these testimonial campaigns, to give this permission structure to Republicans out there that there's someone out there that looks like them, that sounds like them, that votes like them, that is saying what we think is a really important message, that it is important to stand up to an authoritarian thug like Vladimir Putin. It's what Ronald Reagan did against the Soviet Union, and it's what the Republican Party needs to get back to. The sad part about all of this is that there is this isolationist wing of the Republican Party that is growing thanks to Donald Trump's takeover, full-on takeover of the Republican Party.
So it's not about the money. It's not about not wanting to spend money on Ukraine.
I think some of it can come down to money. When you look at what Donald Trump says, he says America first, and I think that some Republicans feel that you're not putting America first if you're spending money elsewhere. We hear this in the focus groups all the time with Republican voters. Why are you spending money elsewhere when we could be spending money here? Because there is this very deep frustration with Republican voters about Joe Biden, the economy, inflation, gas prices. Even if economic indicators in our country are getting better, that doesn't mean that voters are perceiving that they are getting better. And I think that that's playing a major role.
The argument which administration is giving is that this is in the U.S. national security interest. Do Republican voters hear this message?
No, they don't. The thing about Republican voters is oftentimes they silo themselves in the media they consume. They are watching programming. They're only going to hear what they want to hear. And in the focus groups, we hear them regurgitate those talking points back to us. But I will just say what we think is an incredible effective line of messaging is that for 5% of a defense budget, we were able to help Ukraine defeat about 50% of Vladimir Putin's army. And we think that that is a very strong investment because it is in the vital interest of the national security in the United States to stand up to someone like Vladimir Putin, to send a signal to China that you can't mess around with the United States.
Gunnar Raymer, spokesperson for the advocacy group Republicans for Ukraine, speaking with VOA Ukrainian Services' Tatiana Vorosko. President Biden welcomed European Council President Charles Michel and Ursula von der Leyen, president of the European Commission, to the White House on Friday for his second U.S.-EU summit since taking office. The U.S. commitment to Ukraine has become a central question between Biden and the EU leaders. Associated Press correspondent Karen Shamis reports.
Saddled with a dysfunctional Congress, President Joe Biden has the task of assuring EU leaders that the U.S. can deliver billions of dollars worth of aid to Ukraine and Israel. The promise depends on whether or not Biden can get a budget through Congress, a tough task given the recent political chaos in the U.S. The House lacks an elected speaker, and differences with some Republican lawmakers over aid for Ukraine could force a federal government shutdown in November. In a televised address to the American people, the president said he would send an urgent funding request to Congress, adding,
"It's a smart investment that's going to pay dividends for American security for generations."
European Council President Charles Michel expressed optimism that Biden can deliver on his promises to help arm and financially support Ukraine. I'm Karen Shamas.
A United Nations Commission of Inquiry on Ukraine said Friday it had found additional evidence that Russian forces had committed, quote, indiscriminate attacks and war crimes in Ukraine, including rape and the deportation of children to Russia. The report submitted to the UN General Assembly listed deadly attacks on residential buildings and civilian targets in a number of cities. The commission said it had documented cases of rape, quote, with the use of force or psychological coercion. Russia has vigorously denied committing atrocities or targeting civilians in Ukraine. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Lori London. Despite daily Russian attacks across Ukraine, there are indications that Kyiv is making headway in its counteroffensive. For details, I spoke with Anna Chernikova in Kyiv.
This last couple of days, we're discussing mostly Kherson region and the area of Avdiivka in the eastern part of Ukraine, in the eastern front line. And as we hear every day, that Kherson region is under very intensive shelling by the Russian forces. At the same time, we're hearing that Ukrainian forces had certain advance on the left bank of the River of Dnipro, which is still under Russian control. So basically, Ukrainian forces managed to kind of getting through this defense lines by Russian forces. And this was also confirmed by the Institute for the Study of War and indirectly confirmed by the Ukrainian officials. And today we are hearing again, so this Friday, we're hearing from the Institute for the Study of War that actually these actions by Ukrainian forces look much more massive than they used to be, and they're confirming that this is not just another tries of Ukrainians of this little operations that Ukrainians were putting through for the past months, but actually it looks like something more massive and more intense. At this point, we do not have direct comments or details from the Ukrainian authorities on that. However, they are confirming that Ukrainian forces are making certain advances and actions in that area. So we will be keeping our eye on that. But it looks that we might get some big updates from that area of counteroffensive sometime soon.
We're also hearing that Russian President Vladimir Putin has announced that he's ordered fighter jets armed with hypersonic missiles for around-the-clock patrols over the Black Sea. That sounds pretty threatening.
Well, in his latest speech, President Putin actually was kind of threatening the whole world that he would place his MiG fighters in the Black Sea international water, and that basically these fighters, as he said, that these fighters, just for everyone to understand, that these fighters are carrying Kinjal missiles, which can actually destroy any petrol ship and the fighter ship and so on and so forth on the sea. And this was kind of, he was saying this in his usual manner, in this threatening manner. And at this point, satellite images actually confirm that Russia has placed four MiG fighters in Sevastopol at the airfield, Belbek airfield in Sevastopol, which is the main airfield in that area. There is no confirmation if they are carrying Kinjals or not, but at least we can see from the satellite images that they are there. And also Ukrainian spokesman of the Ukrainian Air Force, Yuri Ignat, basically commenting on that, he said that this is definitely increasing tension, but it does not fundamentally change anything for the Ukrainian defense forces. What is important to mention here is that this is another example why Ukraine is set to liberate Crimea and why Ukraine do not want to discuss any other option, because basically Crimea is currently a huge military hub for Russia, and it's not only Ukrainian problem, but as we can see, it's also a problem for the rest of the world if Russia would place their equipment there on the regular basis. So, well, this is another reason why Ukraine is set to liberate the peninsula and is set to continue with the actions and with the attacks on the peninsula.
Anna Chernikova reporting for VOA from Kyiv. We thank you so much.
Thank you.
As Russia's relationship with China deepens and the conflict between Israel and Hamas intensifies, Washington's ability to prevent a wider war is becoming more complicated. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain has more.
President Joe Biden was warmly embraced by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Wednesday, as he made a high-stakes wartime visit to demonstrate U.S. solidarity after the brutal October 7th attacks by Hamas militants on Israeli civilians. But the explosion that killed hundreds of Palestinians Tuesday night at a Gaza hospital thwarted any such embrace from Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas or Jordan's King Abdullah, who canceled their planned meetings with Biden. Both Israel and Hamas deny they are responsible for the hospital blast. In Israel, Biden persuaded Netanyahu to allow international humanitarian aid and to help Gaza's 2.2 million residents, who are in desperate need of food, water, and fuel, saying he hoped crossings will begin Friday.
Israel agreed humanitarian assistance can begin to move from Egypt to Gaza.
Protesters took to the streets in Istanbul and many other cities across the world Wednesday and Thursday in support of Palestinians and against Israeli attacks on Gaza. Some protesters also expressed outrage at the United States for backing Israel, despite intensive shuttle diplomacy by Secretary of State Antony Blinken, who met with Arab leaders across the region. While Blinken and Biden were visiting the Middle East, Russian President Vladimir Putin was welcomed to Beijing by Chinese leader Xi Jinping. Addressing the Israel-Hamas conflict, Putin said that the growing number of world conflicts strengthens ties between Moscow and Beijing. Russia and China have refused to condemn the Hamas attacks on Israeli civilians. One expert told VOA, this crisis has shown that the U.S. is now the only superpower in the Middle East. Michael Kimmage is a professor of history with the Catholic University of America. He spoke to VOA via Zoom.
It is the only superpower that has real military assets, and that's not just assets that it's going to give to Israel in the conflict. It's the two aircraft carriers in the Eastern Mediterranean. It's the security relationships with Jordan, with Egypt, with Saudi Arabia, with surrounding countries. And it is the diplomatic bandwidth to do the kind of conversations and activities that you've seen Secretary Blinken and the president engage in.
Russia and China are working together to upend the global order established after the Second World War. Former Deputy National Security Advisor Matthew Pottinger told VOA.
And now that she is hosting Vladimir Putin in Beijing, it's a continuation of this deepening partnership to try to drive chaos in Europe, to drive chaos in the Middle East, to eventually try to drive chaos right in China's front yard.
But another expert told VOA that unlike Russia, China's interests in the Middle East may be more in line with America's. Brian Katulis is a senior fellow and vice president of policy at the Middle East Institute. He spoke to VOA via Zoom. And the end.
I think China's interest in the Middle East is not for more war and instability, because they're even more dependent on the energy resources of the region.
Katula said that the decision by Palestinian and Egyptian leaders not to meet with Biden so soon after the hospital explosion is not necessarily a sign they are not willing to work with the United States, but that they are sensitive to the reactions on their own streets. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
A Russian-American journalist was ordered Friday to be detained for another 3 days on charges of failing to register as a foreign agent, according to Russian media. State Department spokesman Matthew Miller briefed reporters.
We are aware of reports concerning the detention of Alsu Kurmasheva in Russia. Whenever a U.S. citizen is detained overseas, the department works to provide all appropriate assistance. We have not been officially notified by the government of Russia about this arrest yet, but this is a case we have been tracking.
Alsu Kurmasheva, an editor for the U.S. government-funded Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, appeared in court in the central Russian city of Kazan Friday.
This appears to be another case of the Russian government harassing U.S. citizens, which is why we continue to have a level 4 travel warning.
Kurmasheva is the second U.S. journalist detained in Russia this year after Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich was arrested on espionage charges in March. And that'll do it for us today, but stay up to date with continuing coverage of Ukraine and news from around the world 24 hours a day at voanews.com. And on social media, just follow VOA News. On behalf of all of us here at VOA, we thank you so much for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Lori London.
This is the voice. of America. Washington, D.C.